Hey, pull up a chair. We're so glad to have you join us here on the Back Porch Education Podcast. For the next half hour or so, we're going to talk about all things educational. It's a wonderful day to learn something. Glad you could join us. Well, this podcast does have a purpose, as informal as it may seem, and that is to talk, converse, share with one another about education. So it seemed to Jason and I worthwhile to do a little defining today. So let's start somewhere obvious.
Yeah, let's do it. Steve, let's just skip right to the end here and come out with it. What's education?
Well, first of all, I would say education is something we all do.
Everybody does it?
Yeah. Parents teach their kids. Of course, we have these teachers that get paid to teach, and that's what we tend to think of when we talk about education. But right. I know very few managers or bosses who don't spend a good chunk of their time teaching their employees how to do what they want them to do. We've got whole professions other than teaching that are centered on the notion of teaching. Pastors come to mind rather quickly.
Right.
Citizens attempt to persuade each other of positions in a democracy, which is a form of teaching, in my opinion.
Persuasion is a form of education?
I would think it is.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get you to understand what I'm talking about.
Sure.
The thing that always cracks me up is how much teaching is involved in being a kid. So they're in the backyard, and the one says to the other, hey, I've got this game we can play, and immediately cranks up education to teach the rules to all the kids in the neighborhood so they can play Red Rover or whatnot.
Right.
Or perhaps more modernly, Big Brother promises mom he'll teach little sister how to play Xbox. She doesn't know all the knobs and fidgety widgets, but you teach her how to play it.
Right.
And so brother begrudgingly, you know, teaches her how to lose to him all the time.
Right, true.
So it's everything. A lot of life is education. And so that gives us the difficulty when we're trying to define it. Something that's so common as education that's all around us. If we're going to talk seriously about it, we've got to define it. But we have a pretty big task in front of us because it is so, it encompasses so much. It's not a, oh, education happens over there in that place. We sometimes do that with school, but education really happens all around us all day. And so it's this big concept to define.
Right. Well, I think we're off to a good start. And I know a guy who I think could help us define education. His name is Lee Hunt. And he wrote a little poem called The Glove and the Lions. So if you'll humor me, I'd like to read it and then we can start in earnest.
I feel another poem coming on. Go for it.
The Glove and the Lions by Lee Hunt. King Francis was a hardy king and loved a royal sport. And one day as his lions fought, sat looking on the court. The nobles filled the benches and the ladies in their pride, and amongst them sat the Count de Lourges with one for whom he sighed. And truly, 'twas a gallant thing to see that crowning show, valor and love and a king above and the royal beasts below. Ramped and roared the lions with horrid laughing jaws. They bit, they glared, gave blows like beams, a wind went through their paws. With wallowing might and stifled roar, they rolled on one another, till all the pit with sand and mane was in a thunderous smother. The bloody foam above the bars came whisking through the air. Said Francis, then, faith, gentlemen, were better here than there. De Lourges' love o'erheard the king, a beauteous, lively dame, with smiling lips and sharp, bright eyes, which always seemed the same. She thought, the Count, my lover, is brave as brave can be. He surely would do wondrous things to show his love of me. King, ladies, lovers, all look on. The occasion is divine. I'll drop my glove to prove his love. Great glory will be mine. She dropped her glove to prove his love, then looked at him and smiled. He bowed, and in a moment leapt among the lions wild. The leap was quick, return was quick, as he regained his place. Then threw the glove, but not with love, right in the lady's face. By God, said Francis, rightly done, and he rose from where he sat. No love, quoth he, but vanity sets love a task like that.
All right, well, love, as discussed there, is at the heart, I think, of education. There's a great number of loves in play.
Right.
We tend to think of education as centering around the love someone has for the subject being taught or educated. But equally, obviously, there must be a relationship of love between teacher and student in order for education to happen well. So I think that's part of what's coming out of that experience we just went through with you. That
well, I'm in particular, I'm interested in this beauteous, lively dame when she could she knows that the Count loves her, and yet she tests his love in an attempt to gain glory for herself. And I have to laugh when I think about that. You know, we're not talking about exams and things like that in particular, but I'm just saying, I think there's a little overlap here between the way that we as teachers sometimes treat our students. We not out of love, but we give them tasks out of vanity. And, you know, education that's based on vanity, I would argue, is not education. If it's not based on love, then it's not education.
So, of course, I'm going to sit there administering standardized tests to my students with visions of lions right. tearing each other and the students apart. It's right. wonderful that you give us these images to carry around with us, Jason. I really appreciate that. The poem also, I think, brings out to me this notion that, you know, you read a poem like that and you have a setting that we immediately know is from a long time ago. And we don't have lions and knights and dropped gloves going on today. We have our own forms by which we assess love and by which we rightly and wrongly try out our lovers. But education is a timeless concept, just like love, right? And so, in some form or another, it's been happening for a really long time. And that's always intrigued me. I've always been a history buff. I've always been somebody who believes strongly that that I don't walk around with a whole lot of wisdom shoved in my head at any given moment. But if I'm seeking wisdom, I can find her. The scriptures tell me, and that a lot of it is to be found back there, back in the day. And so when I started teaching, I rather quickly learned the first lesson a teacher learns, which is humility. I don't know if I'm doing this right or not. And history, especially educational history, became sort of a crutch or a really a moral support for me that, hey, even before they had the chalkboard, even before they had books, education could occur. Western civilization was born not in the context of vast libraries, but when writing things down was pretty difficult. So I just went digging. We were kind of asking the question, what is education? I went digging for that. What is it? What has it been defined as in the past? And the thing that surprised me is that I really could only find basically one answer anywhere. If I read prior to 1850, the more modern period that we're in now, 1850 and newer, there's skedaddles of definitions for education, and it gets a little confusing as to which one I want to adopt.
Okay.
But right. prior to 1850, I could only find one definition, and I think it would...
Well, Steve, we got to hear what it is, man.
I'll tell you right after our break.
Right, so like a bad TV show, we left with a big old cliffhanger. Yeah. But Steve, come on now, just out with it. What is that pre-1850 definition of education?
Well, I put it off to build a little suspense because, frankly, when I tell it to you, I think there's going to be a little letdown. It's not incredible in its depth, but when I went hunting, all I could find is some variation of the notion that education is the cultivation of wisdom and virtue. That in the end, the ends sought by the educator from, you know, I went back well into the Hebraic traditions, the Old Testament, that sort of thing. I the Greeks, of course, are fascinating to me. They birthed our civilization and
right.
put together a lot of what we know about education today. And
yeah, sure.
They were pretty much all of one accord. The Romans kept it going right on in the Christian medieval age, European educational history, right? It's only as we reach the modern era and the Enlightenment do people start straying away from the notion that really I educate in order to bring the person being educated to wisdom and to virtue. So,
cultivation, you mentioned too,
right? I use that term. I mean, I could say produce or, the word education itself literally means to lead out. And so right. I think there's a sense of I'm leading them somewhere. Well, where are you going, towards whatever is wise and virtuous and,
Leading out of ignorance maybe, or leading out of
foolishness,
narcissism.
Foolishness yeah. and vice would be the opposite of wisdom and virtue. So I think since 1850, there's been, if we think about the political side of things, there's been a much more of a lack of consensus about what education is trying to accomplish. Horace Mann really is the father of American education and American public education. It was under his leadership that the nation decided that a democracy needed to require all kids to go to school. Of course, compulsory education is an interesting thing. We could do a whole show on that. Can you make students learn? You can make them go to school, but will they learn anything if they're made to go there?
Right. Plato did a whole show on that, didn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
The Meno.
Yeah, maybe we'll just post his show on our
podcast. Right.
But Horace felt that education was a pathway to paradise. He makes a lot of comparisons between the number of schools and the number of prisons in America. To quote him, jails and prisons are the complement of schools. So many less as you have of the latter, so many more must you have of the former. If you don't teach kids the right path, you're going to have prisons to house them for not knowing, which is still within the notion, in my opinion, of at least virtue. He right. might have different definition than I do of what is virtuous, but this is 1881 when he makes this comment.
Yeah. So let's circle back. 1850, you said we kind of start to fracture a little bit, and you said we get more and more definitions. And I've got to say, you know, one thing that kind of just popped into my head, it seems to me that it's about that time that we also start to lose a consensus of what wisdom and virtue are. So it makes sense that we would then not be able to understand education in those terms any longer. If we don't agree on what wisdom and virtue are, how are we going to move everybody to that end?
Right. Well, right? And lacking that consensus in a pluralistic society, we want to give people room to disagree with us.
Right.
So I've had at least one individual tell me, look, you can't go with that definition of education, the cultivation of wisdom and virtue. That's illegal. You can't do that to kids.
Can laws be unjust?
You know, you can't make people say this is good and that is bad. That's their own personal judgment. So it's become very difficult to talk morally about education in a relative setting.
Right. Increasingly pluralistic, maybe we would say. So, okay, let's do this though. Okay, so Horace Mann, I kind of stole his thunder a little bit. You're telling me that Horace Mann said, the less schools we have, the more prisons we'll need.
Right. And he said the opposite. I got to find the quote still, but I know this is my problem is I read and then I don't take careful notes and I can't find my quotes, but I guarantee you at some point he said, give me 50 years and compulsory education and prisons won't be necessary in America anymore. Now, 1881, wow. We're sitting here in 2018 and regularly talking as a society about prison overcrowding, not, wow, we've right. got all these empty prisons. What are we going to do with the buildings?
Right. And schools are
right.
crowded too. You'd
think if his theory was true, we would have plenty of space in the old prisons to now have school, which is in and of itself a horrific picture. But I've had some students say that prisons right. and schools are constructed in the same architecture. But Mann sort of passed the baton to John Dewey in the early 20th century, and he further sort of reduced or narrowed, reducted, it's not a word, reduced education to a set of useful skills for living well with others.
Okay. So wait, before we jump right into his stuff, his theories, let me sort of show my own ignorance and say I don't know a ton about Dewey, but what I do know is that in the world of education, with teachers that I've worked with and taught with and talked with, there's kind of two camps. Well, I guess there's three. The first is people who don't really know John Dewey. but then the second and third would be those people, those teachers who can't stand Dewey. He's a sort of the boogeyman of education. And the third group would then be those who think he is the second coming, like this messiah of education who finally figured it out and saved us from this moralistic, root that we came from or whatever. So what's the big deal? Why are his ideas so divisive? Should we have another cliffhanger here?
No. I think I can fit this in before we take our last break. So you hit it right on the head. Coming out of the 1800s, there was this desire in education to move away from what was considered the negative stereotype of squeezing children into the educational form. There was a lot of memory work. There was, of course, a lot of discipline. There was a lot of copying and teaching handwriting very carefully and all these things. And by the time you get to the 20th century, Dewey is a fellow who, and you're absolutely right, the people that love him and people that hate him and people that know anything about him, but of his lovers and his haters, his big business card has, you know, personal experience on the front of it.
Oh.
To him, education wasn't this broad brush that you painted all the children with. The best education met the child where they were and individuated all instruction to not just what the child needed, but even what the child wanted and what society needed from that child. There's a collective strain in Dewey. He's influenced for sure by collectivist politics. I'm not going to call him a socialist, but he was.
Okay. nice.
He at least was thinking of education as something that would provide the kind of citizens who cared more about the group, the many, than their own individual welfare, even though his methodology sort of seemed to be the opposite. Let's meet every child where they are. Let's meet them and mold them into good citizens. And so it's just a different box, in my opinion. But education's always been trying to lead a child somewhere. And so Dewey's direction was much different than Wisdom or Virtue. But it was still this notion that if I, as a teacher, am going to address a student, it's to take them from where they're at to someplace. And so to me, the definition of education has to include some final destination. I'm comfortable with it being Wisdom and Virtue. It's hard to define that today, what we mean by that. But many educators, you know, have different ends in mind when they're defining education.
Okay, Steve. So we ended our last segment there with you talking about Dewey and his sort of educational theories, the fact that you weren't going to call him a socialist and stuff like that. But you said something, and I want to try and get it clear in my own mind. You said Dewey wanted to make good citizens of the pupils that he was educating. And that seems to me to be not such a bad thing. I mean, it seems like the, you know, Plato, Aristotle, and on down the line, seems like everybody would agree with that. Making good citizens is a good idea. It is a proper end even of education. So does Dewey mean something different, or what's going on there?
Well, and I'm glad you went back to Plato, because that's where I tend to go as well. In the Republic, you've got those in need of education chained in a cave, looking at shadows on the wall. They are not in what we would call a free position. They are chained up.
Right.
And so education became this term we use to discuss from the Platonic analogy that's given to us there. Leading others, we're free. We've been out in the light. We've seen it. Now we're back in the cave, unchaining the next generation and leading them out into the bright light of the truth. So, okay. And that's well and fine. But enlightenment comes along and says, you had it all wrong when you started out assuming that the child was in a bad situation. Children are innocent. We got to probably, it's Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who's the father of the French Revolution, bless his soul. He's there with this notion of the blank slate or the innocent, right? Who, instead of starting with someone who is maybe full of vice or at least untrained in virtue, he's looking at the student as naturally good, and all he needs is the right direction.
Okay.
And so Dewey's pulling off of that modernist format that I, as a Christian, have to disagree with their basic premise that the dear little angels that walk into my classroom really have no problems unless I give them problems My job is to steer their good hearts towards utopia. And,
okay,
you know, I know I'm overstating the case to some extent, but not by a large. You can find this in their writings. Dewey believed in this notion that what a kid really needs, what he will experience as a joyous education, is when you put tools in his hands that help him serve others, serve the state, be productive. He had no problem with the notion of the kid making a lot of money along the way. And so there's these altruisms that are being pursued there, that to him was what education was setting the right carrots in a row down the garden pathway, and the rabbit will follow, so to speak. And okay. That's a real shift.
And the ancients. Yeah. Talk about
the shift. Ancients argued over the nature of man, but they generally believed that the nature of man needed to be conformed, come into unity with the realities of the world, right? And so Christianity in particular had this full, very busy curricula of, as we talked about earlier, seven virtues, the whole pathway was laid out that by catechizing a child, by teaching them the way they should go, they would move towards righteousness. They would seek wisdom. Fear of the Lord was the beginning of that, and that they would live a happy life by pursuing the highest good. The modern educator has changed that a little bit by basically saying education is to allow the greatest good, which is the student, to shine.
Mm-hmm.
The happiness is not out there to be found with seven liberal arts that we'll give you to find it with. It's inside you, and education's main purpose is to gift you with the necessary skills to let it out.
Okay. So can I bring it? I want to try and bring it into a metaphor. And this is an untested metaphor. So if it's bad, just throw it out. But from what you have just said, kind of what the image that came to mind was, the we'll call them the moderns, or the, you know, post Enlightenment thinkers, Rousseau and others, would say the plant, that is the child, just needs to be given the food and water, or whatever, the nourishment that it wants, and then however it grows, then that will be the best form of that plant. But the ancients were saying, no, the plant must be given the nourishment that we believe is best for it, that we know is best for it, and it must be pruned if it is going to be the best form of the plant.
Yeah, it's a good analogy. The ancients said there's this ideal outside you that we're calling you to. It's above all our heads.
Right. That's Plato. Okay. And others.
Yeah. Let's strive to be the best that we can be. And to do that, we need tools. We need knowledge, and we need understanding. We need wisdom. We need truth, goodness, and beauty to show us the way. The modern says the ideal's inside us. And so what you need are the tools that allow you to express that. So we'll let this tree grow any old way it wants, rather than being harsh to it and staking it out and tying it and binding it and guiding it so that it grows up straight. Well, that's your idea of what a tree ought to look like.
Mm-hmm.
The kid might have a totally different idea, and we should let them seek their way. We're right here to make sure that they don't harm themselves while they're seeking their way, but you don't want to in any way inhibit their own self-expression. And it's led us to a lot of crazy, at least in my opinion, crazy things where I see third graders being asked to write creatively, for instance.
Right. Well, and that's what I was just going to ask is, you know, to extend my metaphor even further, it sounds like the moderns, we'll call them the moderns, their ideal gardener is the gardener who trusts the plant more than himself. And as a gardener of kids, as a teacher, that's really paralyzing. Because what am I supposed to do? You know, right. How then should I act?
Right. And as you and I have talked about the foci of this podcast, one of the things we've both been very passionate about is pushing back on this notion that teaching is a highly specialized, only professionals should don't try this at home kind of thing. It's just, I can't accept that. Education is too ubiquitous. Everybody does it. And if we have to limit education to only the trained professionals who have been carefully shown how to do this thing, I think that more than anything else makes parents afraid. I've got to go find the experts to tell me how to do this when it really isn't that complicated. And of course, in saying that, I've gotten us to that wonderful time each day when we have to stop the podcast and say we'll be back with more in the future.
Awesome. Steve, good talking with you, man.
Good talking with you. We'll see you next time. Well, thanks again for joining us in this great conversation about education. We hope you will not just listen, but participate. Leave us a comment, suggestion, or thought on our website. You just never know when we'll use it on the show. Until next time, pursue joy and learn something.